pauses in English. Okay. So, my name is Ray. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm from Riken Ikagaku Kenkyujo up in Saitama, near Tokyo. So, anyways, Hiroaki asked me to give a couple of lectures to you guys. And so, I realize English can be difficult for some of you. So I'll try to slow down as much as I can. Okay, so you guys, 頑張ってください. And but if you can't hear me, feel free to move forward a little bit so that you can hear well. Because my voice is not huge. So you just have to listen carefully. If you can't, you can come up. And I like to conduct my class in a very kind of discussion-like format so I can talk to you guys and figure out what you guys are interested. So whenever you have a question, just feel free to stop at any point. There's a little bit more material than I need to go over in the slides. So don't worry about having to kind of write down everything in the slides. So some of the material is for like kind of more advanced stuff. I'll just tell you kind of the important stuff that you should concentrate on. Okay. So first of all, can you guys all see these slides? It's fine. The lighting is okay. You can see okay. Just let me know if there's any problem. So I'll try to keep things interesting and cool as well. So here we go. So the first lecture, they're actually somewhat related, but the first lecture is actually going to be about movements. Okay. So we make movements all the time. The question is, how does our brain control movements? For example, when you're playing baseball, if you're a pitcher, pitch on. You have to put the ball in a certain specific place, right? So the catcher's like looking around, and then the pitcher is like, okay, I got to hit exactly that spot. But how does the pitcher, like, know exactly, how can I make the throw so that it's exactly on that spot? If you don't have the proper control, you throw, and oh, it's going to go up there somewhere, right? So this is related to an area of the brain called cerebellum, which is in the back of our brain. Okay. Has anybody heard of the cerebellum before? No, first time? Don't worry, I'll fill you in on the details. So this back of the part of the brain called cerebellum is involved in controlling these types of movements. Okay. So I'll tell you how this occurs. So the way my lecture is going to go, the first half, a little bit more than half, is more introductory material, stuff just to teach you and try to understand how things work. And then sort of the last one third or so is a little bit about a little bit more advanced research. And so what I'll do is I give you a quick sort of a review quiz kind of thing before that part. So that very last part, you should listen, but you don't have to really know everything. You don't need to. But the first half or so, make sure you pay attention so you know what's going on, so that you can use it to understand the second half. Is that clear? Okay. So why do I call it playing the piano without the brain? That's because most of the time people think of the cerebellum, which is this back part of the brain. They think of it as such a primitive, old part of the brain that it doesn't count as brain. It doesn't count as cortex. But what I'll show you today is that actually you need it for a lot of very critical things, including things like playing the piano. So I start with a very, very general story, okay? So both of these lectures are linked by a common theme, actually, it turns out. And this is the theme that I talk about. So you know that there's tons and tons of people on Earth, especially in like places like China and India. There's a lot of people. This picture was taken in India. You know that each individual has tons of neurons in the brain, 10 to the 11th. So even more brains in the human brain than there are people on this Earth. So it's pretty crazy. If you zoom in now further from the person to the cells in the body into a single cell, you realize that actually there is almost half as much synapses onto a single cell. So synapse is where the cells are connected to each other. So there's just as many connections, on the order of magnitude connections, between cells as there are cells themselves. So that's something that people kind of neglect a lot. It's like, well, we have a lot of cells, but the question actually is that cells are connected to each other in so many different ways. Just as human beings are connected to each other. Like your Facebook friend, you have some other Facebook friend. Well, that Facebook friend could be like 1,000 times whatever your person's possibility is. So there's so many ways to connect just two people around the world, even from two connections. Okay. So how is this related? It's related because we want to think of neuroscience, which is what I study, the brain, the way the brain works. We want to think about it as a kind of a microscope. So first you have people who are interacting in the world, like a sociology and society. But the question is, within that individual, how does the cells themselves also interact? And it turns out the stories that they have, the cells communicate with each other, different types of cells, kind of mirrors the real world. Just like there's tons of different types of people, Japanese, American, wherever. Cell types also, turns out I'm going to tell you about Purkinje cells, granule cells, they all look really different. They speak a different language of communication, and they're connected to each other in different ways. So it kind of mirrors the way we interact as well. So if you understand that lower end of it, that allows you to have some idea of how the sociology also works. Okay, so that's the big story. So now I want to talk about the first lecture, what we're going to talk about. So the first lecture, we're talking about movements. Okay, so this is from a movie, famous movie back in the days called My Fair Lady. So basically, the idea is that movements is controlling everything, right? So everything you do in the world, including breathing, you're controlling your lungs, right? Everything actually based on muscles. And those muscles are controlled mostly in this cerebellum, brainstem, general area. And the cerebellum actually is a specific area for not exactly producing movements, but for refining the movements. So I said earlier about pitching, right? Baseball, right? So without the cerebellum, you can still throw the ball. You just don't know where it goes. But with the cerebellum, you're able to fine-tune every tiny specific muscle so that you can actually hit right exactly where you need to hit. Similar to playing the piano. Without the cerebellum, you're not going to be able to give those really fine-tuned, quick movements. You can make big movements, but you can't make these kind of movements without cerebellum. So cerebellum is really important. Let me just tell you about why it's important. So it turns out there's a few possibilities when the cerebellum gets damaged. Okay, so you guys should know these. So one is called hypotonia, and that is basically when you have a reduction in the resistance of your gait, right? So for example, if you're not able to have resistance when you're touching something, when you push on something, then you don't have this hypotonia. So the classic symptom that people see is that they put the arm down here and they say, don't do anything, just relax. And then over time it just stops, right? Because gravity acts and you have this tone in the resistance of your muscle so that eventually it comes down. It turns out in the cerebellar patients, they actually go like this. They don't know how to stop. Okay. Even when they're asked to just be natural. Okay. So that's number one, hypotonia. And that's having to do with lack of ability to control for the resistance, right, of these muscles. There's also something called astasia. So the name is not so important, but the idea is that they can't walk properly. So it's crazy, but without cerebellum, you can't even do simple things like walk. So what you see in these patients, I can demonstrate for you, is that instead of walking normally like I'm doing now, what they do is because they can't control these very fine-tuned movements of pressure points, they have to go like this. Have you seen these people before? Where they have to go like this? The reason is if they go like this, they have more areas in the foot so that they can control better the ground. Without that, they can't, you know, they can't do things like this. Right? Like, so they can't, like, dance and things like that. So it's a big deal. There's also ataxia, which is basically irregular movements. You've probably seen these types of people before also. They kind of, you know, like this, right? They look like they're drunk, but actually they can't control their movements. So here, there's some randomly generated movements that the cerebellum cannot act to suppress, to inhibit. So normally the cerebellum is going to inhibit certain types of movements that you don't want as well. And so that's called ataxia, where you go this irregular. Okay. It's not that they're crazy. They just have, you know, some damage to the cerebellum, for instance. Okay. And then the next one I'm going to show you in the movie. The next one is interesting is because you see these a lot in people with certain diseases such as Parkinson's. So what that is that it's called intention tremor. And so basically what happens is that usually you need when you're making a movement, you need one muscle to flex, okay, to tighten, and you need another muscle to relax. So there are always pairs of muscles, right? So for example, so if you flex your biceps, right? When you flex this bicep muscle is gonna flex, right? It's gonna become shorter. But this one in the back called the tricep has to relax, right? Because everything is based on this antagonistic muscle group. When you go like this, now the tricep is gonna flex, and then the bicep is gonna relax. So everything here is based on muscle groups. Intention tremor refers to the fact that you can't have fine control of these pairs. So that's why you get these errors in the control of how you can make movements. So let me just show you. Easier to just kind of show you. This is intention tremor. Okay, so watch that. When he tries to stay on target, he can't do that. He's asked to point his finger to the nose. When he finds the nose, he keeps tremoring, right? See that? Now, notice, during the movement, there's actually nothing wrong. You see that? Did you guys miss that? So during the movement from here to here and back, there's no problem. It's interesting, right? That's because during the actual movement, and I'll show you again. So, because during the actual movement, the motor program is already started, and the cerebellum, in this case, was not damaged in such a way that they can't make this actual movement. But in the stationary state, they can't keep straight. It's because the antagonistic muscles are out of sync. One is telling them to go now, the other one is telling them to go the other way. They can't keep still. But when you actually make the movement, there's no problem. You can just move, but they can't control the stationary time. Okay. So what you can see, what you can see basically from what I just showed you is that there's a bunch of different errors that can occur. You can have a reduction in the resistance, right? You have the inability to have tone in your muscle. You can have these irregular movements, and you can have this error in the way, in the stationary state, you control your muscles. Okay. So it's really important, because when you have cerebellar damage, people, it's very difficult for them. Okay. So this is why the cerebellum is important. So what is it about the structure of the cerebellum that allows it to actually make these really fine movements? Okay. So again, you don't have to know every detail here. I'm just giving you some ideas. So it turns out there's a bunch of different compartments in the cerebellum. What we're going to focus on is that So it's going to be this area called the cerebellum, lateral cerebellum. It turns out the cerebellum has different areas. For example, there's a deeper area called the deep nuclei, and that's kind of involved in giving you these global movements, these big intentional movements. It turns out there's some reflex also that's kind of undertaken without cerebellum, for example, the spinal cord. So some people do the knee reflex where you go like boom and this thing comes out. That does not require cerebellum. That's in the spinal cord, it turns out. Okay. So these are all important things. I'm not going to talk about it particularly. I'm going to focus on the lateral cerebellar cortex, and that's where the fine-tuning happens. Okay. All right. So there's lots of cells in the cerebellum. So first I'll just tell you about how the cerebellum is organized, and then I'll tell you about how the cells are actually connected. Okay. First, there's this layer called the granule cell layer in the cerebellar cortex. This is the lateral cerebellum I was talking about. So that area, okay, let's concentrate on this middle picture here. So that's kind of in this yellow area. So there's lots of tiny little cells called granule cells. And granule cells are the most numerous cell type actually in the human brain. Okay. Why do you need so many cell types? I'll tell you about later. There's also what are called interneurons. So interneurons are just inhibitory cells. So they inhibit instead of exciting. I'll tell you about them as well. So that's the granule cell layer in this yellow region. Okay. There's also this thing called the Purkinje cell layer. So Purkinje cell layer is this orange area right here. Right? So the Purkinje cell layer is basically forms the output of the cerebellum cortex. Okay? So everything that comes in eventually gets processed, mostly in the granule cells and also in the way they go into the Purkinje cells. But the Purkinje cell is the sole output. Okay? So everything gets processed, but the Purkinje cell interprets it and gives the actual ultimate output. And it's up to whatever downstream of the cerebellar cortex to interpret that signal. It turns out most of these cells are basically going to the deep nuclei area. And the deep nuclei area is kind of volitional movements, but the Purkinje cell now kind of modifies that movement slightly. Right. So this is why the cerebellar cortex is fine-tuning, because there is already a motor output in the deep nuclei and also in different areas of the brain, our motor cortex, for example. But the Purkinje cells are actually going to modify that output just a little bit. And the way it does that is it uses feedback to figure out what's good and what's not good, and then it learns that process. Okay, so I'll tell you about how that happens later. There's also the molecular layer. Okay, so molecular layer is this very thin layer right here, in the kind of red here. Basically, in the molecular layer, that's where the connection between the granule cell to the Purkinje cell happens. Right, because it turns out the axons of these granule cells, which are the output of the granule cells, they actually project to the Purkinje cell, so they connect to the Purkinje cell. These are synapses I talked about. They synapse onto Purkinje cells, and Purkinje cells go out. In the molecular layer, there are also some other types of inhibitory cells that modifies these pathways. Okay, so granule cells, a bunch of cells types, and also where the input comes in. Purkinje cell, the ultimate output. Molecular layer, where they are connected to each other. How granule cell connects to Purkinje cell. Okay, all clear? Any questions so far? Good. Speak quiz later. Quiz. Okay. So Purkinje cells themselves, it turns out. Okay? So I said the Purkinje cells are the ultimate output. But the Purkinje cells themselves actually are inhibitory. This is kind of a mindfuck, right? It's weird. So the output is Purkinje cell, but the Purkinje cells actually are inhibitory. Okay? So what the idea is that in the deep nuclei and other structures, they're actually giving you the motor output, right? But the Purkinje cell is telling them to stop. Right? So this muscle group is going to go hard on the throw, but it's telling them to make that a curveball, like slightly change the finger a little bit so that it's a little bit less. You know? So the Purkinje cell is actually an inhibitory signal, telling that the downstream structures, don't move that much, just move a little bit. You know? That's the idea. So the question is, how do you have inhibitory cells form this really fine tone tuning role, okay? Alright, so now we know the different cell types, right? The Purkinje cell, granule cells, right? And also the interneurons, which are inhibitory. Now I want to tell you about how they're connected. So we're going to spend a lot of time on this so that you guys really know what's going on. So don't worry if it's new to you, it's okay. So again, we're in the cerebral cortex, okay? So it turns out that the Purkinje cells and the granule cells are connected by parallel fibers. These are axons of granule cells. So axons means the output structures of these cells, okay, where they're outputting their signals. So the granule cells, again, there's a bunch of them. Think of them as actually in this picture, they're kind of like down here. So you can see these individual small cells are as granule cells. And then they send their axon up into this layer, in the molecular layer. And then they're going to, they're going to branch out, right, in separate directions and go in separate parallel orders. That's why they're called parallel fibers. And they're going to connect to the Purkinje cells. And the Purkinje cells actually are these... So they receive this input from the parallel fibers in these big tree-like structures. Okay? The tree-like structure is actually the input into the Purkinje cell. They're called dendrites. Okay? So one Purkinje cell is like here. So like for example, you concentrate on this Purkinje cell. Okay? So this Purkinje cell, the input into that is this stuff out here. You guys are seeing my cursor? You see that? This big, beautiful tree. So that big, beautiful tree is receiving many different inputs from many different parallel fibers. And now it's going to be... So all these fibers go into the Purkinje cell to help control when they get to five. Okay? So let me just say that again. So the granule cells, they send their axons all the way up here. Parallel fibers are moving... parallel to this, actually. I'll show you in a different picture later. But eventually, they're going to synapse. They're going to stop onto one Purkinje cell somewhere, right? I mean, they actually are going to synapse to different ones as well. But, you know, anyways, they're going to stop and synapse one Purkinje cell and then another Purkinje cell, another Purkinje cell. But that information goes from this tree-like structure called a dendrite back to the cell body of the Purkinje cell, and then the Purkinje cell is going to fire downstream to control inhibition of movements. Okay? Clear? Okay. So this is what it looks like. So if everybody's okay with parallel fibers, Purkinje cells, and granule cells, I'm going to move on. Okay? Okay, so here's the additional parts that come into the cerebellum, okay? So first of all, you have two different inputs, right? Remember, you have one output, which is the Purkinje cells, but you have two different inputs, right? So first, I want to tell you about this one, which is called the MASI fiber input, okay? The MASI fiber input actually are the motor signals that you're getting. Okay, so for example, if you're moving around in the world, the sensation comes in and tells you, okay, like, these are the movements that I can make, right? That's actually the MASI fiber. So that's kind of the input motor signal that you can now modulate. So remember, Purkinje cells are actually modulating motor movements. Well, how do you modulate movements? Well, you have to be able to read the movements first. So the MASI fibers are actually coming in through a different stream. And that actually will tell you these are the motor movements that I'm interested in modulating, right? So, for example, if you're going back to throwing a baseball, well, the idea of throwing the baseball, the motor pattern of just throwing the baseball, that's the MASI fiber, right? But, of course, you can't throw it in a very fine-tuned, exact, detailed way yet without this cerebellar cortex. But the idea of it comes in as MASI fiber. And so what they do is they actually synapse onto granule cells. There are kind of these very elaborate structures here, right? They're called glomerulus, but it's not important. Basically, you have one MASI fiber kind of in a hub of these connections with the granule cells. And this is why you have so many granule cells also, because there are so many possible types of motor movements involving so many different muscle groups. Okay? So MASI fibers are going to be coding for motor information all throughout the body. Right? So all that information is going to be coming into the cerebellar cortex. So you need tons of cells to be able to code different types of movements. Right? So for throwing a ball even, right, you have possibility of using the arm, this finger, this finger, this finger, this finger. Right? You can use your elbow. You know, there's so many different muscle groups, possible motor movements that can happen. While the cerebellum needs all that information in order to know what to modify precisely. So the body just says, send it all in the MASI fiber. Okay, so that's one input. Okay, now the second input, possibly even more critical, are the climbing fibers. Okay, so climbing fiber, what they do is they synapse one-to-one onto Purkinje cells. So there's one climbing fiber for one Purkinje cell. Unlike the MASI fiber parallel fiber pathway, right? So the MASI fiber to granule cell to parallel fiber pathway is going to hit all the relevant Purkinje cells. If I want to throw a baseball, I'm going to hit the Purkinje cell for this finger, Purkinje cell for this finger, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The climbing fiber is one-to-one. And what it's actually doing is that it's coming in from this other area called inferior olive. And this inferior olive actually gets innervation from the deep nuclei, which is the target of the Purkinje cell. So what you notice, without knowing the names, but just looking at the circuit, what you notice is that you have Purkinje cell going to this area, nuclei, deep nuclei, this area going to the inferior olive going back to Purkinje cell, right? So what does that look like? That's a feedback circuit. What that means is that whatever the Purkinje cell is outputting, it's also reading out what's going on. So the Purkinje cell changes something, the output of the deep nuclei gets read through the climbing fiber, and the climbing fiber goes back and modifies the Purkinje cell. Okay? So what happens is actually the climbing fiber actually makes a really big spike. So first, going back to the MASI fiber, parallel fiber, MASI fiber, parallel fiber going into Purkinje cell, these are just small, you know, regular spikes, right? So if you can see, if you're recording from a cell, it looks like this. You're sitting on the Purkinje cell, right? You can read off firing the Purkinje cell. The MASI fiber is just going to tell boom, 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 boom. Okay? Now, climbing fiber is totally different. Climbing fiber, basically, they give you these big calcium spikes. So how it does that is that it wraps around the entire dendritic tree. So if you notice, the climbing fiber kind of just hits one little guy and then moves on, right? In this big tree. But in this climbing fiber, the synapse is onto all the trees area. So you're getting a big, big, big innervation, big chunk, right? So when the climbing fiber fires, in the Purkinje cell, you read off this big thing called the complex spike. Okay? It turns out the complex spike, I'll tell you later how, but it turns out the complex spike is actually going to modulate the Purkinje cell connection with parallel fibers. Okay? And if you modify that, you're going to learn. Right? You're going to learn what motor inputs are good, what motor inputs are not good, basically. So you're telling it, okay, you want to move this way, but you don't want to move that way. So is that clear? So the big idea is that the climbing fiber is an error signal. It's error signal in the sense that whatever the Purkinje cell outputs, if it's not the right thing, it's not exactly the thing that's giving you the right movement. So for example, I'm throwing my ball this way. Oh, wait a minute. Like, if you keep going that way, it's going to go that way. Boom, climbing fiber tells this Purkinje cell to go more that way. Or the Purkinje cell tells the deep nuclei to go more that way. So, but throughout this process, this is happening all the time. Climbing fiber, right? Every time it's modifying the Purkinje cell output so that you're getting the fine-tuned movements. Okay. It turns out actually the climbing fiber, that big spike, is actually going to modify the it's actually modifying a connection, modifying a synapse, right? So it's modifying this parallel fiber to Purkinje cell connection. It's actually modifying those a little bit beforehand, right? 120 milliseconds beforehand, it turns out. So the guys who are coming in 120 milliseconds before the first motor signal are actually said to be, oh wait, you're a little bit wrong, let's change it a little bit. So that's why these motor movements are not, you know, you can't, it's not simultaneous. It's not like you just make one fine tune, right? It's like, for example, when you're playing the piano, it's like, oh wait, this is not right, I gotta try it again, this is not right. It's because there's a delay, and you have to learn that delay to anticipate where you need to be. Right. Okay, so the big idea, basically, MOSI fiber are motor signals coming in. Climbing fiber is the error signal, telling you this is not good, try that. Okay. And you can read it out in the Purkinje cell in the different ways that you have the spikes. Right? The big spikes versus the tiny little ones. Okay. This is a good place to ask for questions. Any questions so far? I know it's a little bit complicated, but so hang in there. Okay. Alright. As I was saying before, the outputs are the Purkinje cells and is an inhibitory signal. If you notice, this whole circuit is actually negative feedback, which means whatever I did wrong, it comes back in the form of climbing fiber to tell me not to do that again. Okay. Now, what are parallel fibers doing? We concentrated on Purkinje cells, we concentrated on the inputs, granule cells. Well, it turns out the granule cells going to Purkinje cell takes time as well. Right? So that's part of the reason why you need this kind of 120 millisecond delay, but that motor connection needs time. So actually, this is why learning, it takes time to actually learn these fine-tuned movements. It's not automatic. So, it's a relay station, right? It's going from the granule cells into the Purkinje cell. They're actually especially slow because they're not well insulated, unlike other parts of the brain. Okay. It turns out there are actually different cell types in this area that also inhibit or excite. Okay? In my research that I'll tell you a little bit later, there's a specific cell type that modifies how fast the granule cell parallel fiber to Purkinje cell connection can be. Okay? So I'll tell you about how that takes place. There are a couple of concepts I want to get across. If you don't understand, it's okay. I'll try to keep it as simple as I can. So one concept involved with this cerebellar circuit is the idea that things are sparsely coded. Okay? The idea of sparse coding is the following. So you have a bunch of granule cells, right? Why do you need so many? Right? It turns out it's only a very, very small number of them are coding for the right information for a particular movement. Okay? It's like, for example, if you're interested in the part that's throwing this baseball, right? Well, that's too much point. Let's go into catching the baseball. Okay? You're interested in the one that's catching the baseball, okay? If that's the case, only a very small number of granule cells are firing at any time, because only a small number of MOSI fibers are coding for what you're interested in. So that's all it is, sparse coding. Why do you need so many? Because they're the universe of possibilities. Remember that first slide where I show you number of people on Earth? The universe of possibilities is huge. That's why you need all of them. Okay. The other concept, I think I'll skip a little bit for now. It's a little bit complicated. I'll tell you a little bit. The other concept is that there's a lot of feedback occurring in the circuit. So I already told you about this kind of climbing fiber to Purkinje cell loop, right? Purkinje cell, right? So Purkinje cell, too much activation comes back, climbing fiber tells you, no, don't give me that. So there's that negative feedback right there. It turns out, in other parts of the cerebellar cortex, with other inhibitory cells, you also have loops of inhibition. And they can actually be either positive feedback or negative feedback. This is kind of complicated, but negative feedback is like, this guy talks, shut up! Okay, this guy stops talking. That's negative feedback. Okay? It's very simple, right? Shut up! And then a negative feedback. No. Okay. Can I just talk a little bit? No! Okay? That's negative feedback. Positive feedback is actually the other way, right? This guy starts talking. So maybe I should stop. Keep talking. Okay, alright, let's keep talking. So it's like, the more he talks, the more somebody tells him to keep talking. That's positive feedback. It's kind of like what I'm doing right now, actually. I just keep going, positive feedback. So that's kind of a different, it's not opposite, it's just a different way of doing things, okay? In one way, you're controlling by saying, okay, that's not good, keep it down. The other way, you're telling, okay, that's good, keep going. In the real world, both of those things are happening all the time. So that's why in the circuit, you also have both of those things happening. Okay. Right. It's a little advanced stuff, so I'll just keep going. I want to tell you a little bit about how it's relevant. Okay, so I talked all this time about cerebellum in kind of a slice preparation, like this is what happens when you take it out of the brain and these little circuits, right? But a lot of people also study cerebellum in, for example, humans and almost like more globally, like cognitive ideas, right, of how cerebellum works. And what I want to say is that actually cerebellum, it looks like it's just doing the fine movements, but it turns out it's doing a bunch of very bimiona, like subtle things in other ways. Okay, so I don't want to discount those, so I'll tell you about them right now. So for example, here's one experiment why people see that, well, cerebellum is not just like movements, right? So here we have the first thing I'm talking about is this thing called serial timing task, right? So in the serial timing, people just say, so for example, you give a do, 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 right? So if you listen to that, they're asked to say, well, what do you think the speed of that is? Or what do you think the duration between the first and the second do is, right? So they just ask people. Right? Okay. So, when you do that, actually, when you have lesion in the cerebellum, it turns out that patients actually cannot do this properly. Like, they don't have the proper timing for doing this. If you tell somebody, stop, okay, is that about 1 second or 5 seconds? You guys all know, right? Okay, it's probably about 1 second. But people who are there, they can't figure out. I can't figure it out. I just can't figure it out. So they actually have so this is beyond just movements, right? It's not movement. It's actually judgment of time. So what people say is that actually these people actually don't have a proper sense of time, actually. The speed is messed up. The duration is actually messed up. Okay. Another clue that the cerebellum is involved in different things, right? Is when you have people do one task in which they just read out the word, okay? So here's an experiment. They sit there, usually in some scanner that can image the brain. But anyways, they sit there and they go like, okay, read these words one at a time. So they show you a word, for example, school, next word, you know, anime, next word, et cetera, right? Now, in one version of the task, they just read it out loud. They just read it, okay? In the other task, they read the word, and then they have to think in their brain some associated word without saying anything, okay? So, for example, they give you school, and you think class, or something, or some other word, whatever you want. But they don't say it out loud. They just say school, think class. Okay, next word. Anime, manga, you know, whatever. You think of some word that's related, right? But you just say the word that's on the screen. Now, on the surface, the output is the same, right? Because in both cases, they're just reading exactly the word that's there. It turns out, just by doing this, just by thinking of that other word, they have more activation of the right cerebellum, when specific part of the cerebellum gets more activation. So again, that's not just movement, right? That's saying that the cerebellum somehow, even when it's not output as a behavior, it's doing some other cognitive thing, right? It's hard to put your finger on, but it is actually doing some other thing, right? In this case, some sort of association-driven event. Okay. Similarly, there's other tasks that I can tell you all day about. So, for example, there's another one where they just move some pegs around, but you have a game in which the pegs are actually fitting into a puzzle. So, in one task, you just move the pegs, just use your arms. The other one, you're doing the same sequence, but you're actually solving it, and again, you get greater activation of cerebellum. So it doesn't prove it. It doesn't say that, well, if you knock down the cerebellum, can you get rid of the peg-solving ability without changing the peg's moving ability? It doesn't say that, because in humans, you can't do these studies very easily. But it is a correlation that while there's something going on, it actually is getting more activated somehow in a more cognitive version of the task. So are we okay with the cerebellum? It's kind of a mess, right? It's able to finally control movements, but in humans, there are some subtleties. There could be some association types of things going on. Okay, I guess I need to move forward. Okay, so I told you earlier about how the climbing fiber input actually modifies learning, right? It modulates learning in the cerebellum. So the reason is the following. So what I'm showing you here are the Purkinje cell outputs, right? The Purkinje cells are firing, okay? So down on these, you know, if you concentrate on the upper one, these are the Purkinje cell firing, right? So, and this is the movement that's associated. What that says is that the Purkinje cell firing is associated with inhibition of the downstream signal so that the wrist is bent back this way. Can you guys see this? Yeah, the wrist movement is on this
on this continuous graph. Okay. So what happens now is you can have climbing fiber modulation. So in the second graph, the climbing fiber is actually going to fire right before this movement, right? So what happens is that when it does fire right before this, after you do it a bunch of times, right, in a new context, actually that firing of the Purkinje cell is reduced. You see that on the lower one? You see how it's reduced compared to the upper two, right, the firing, just at that point. When this happens, actually the wrist movement becomes a little bit smoother and also a little bit less. Okay. So what that's saying is that the climbing fiber actually is modulating the Purkinje cell output so that in the regular task, now in a different situation, it's able to learn to adapt. Okay. Now, how does it actually do this? I don't have time to go over the very subtle details, but what I can tell you is that there's actually a model developed by Masao Ito, actually. He was kind of a famous neuroscientist in Japan. He was actually also founded the Riken Brain Science Institute, which is where I'm doing my research. So what he did was actually follow up on the work of David Marr and also Albus, in which they have a model of the way the cerebellum works. And it's basically what I told you about, mostly, okay? So you have the input through the MASI fibers, parallel fibers connect them to the Purkinje cell. Purkinje cell output gets fed back as a climbing fiber modulation of this synapse. So the idea is that the parallel fiber to Purkinje cell synapse, right? So that's where you're getting that motor information. That synapse is modulated, actually kind of tuned down. Right? It's called long-term depression. But the idea is that you're just tuning down those synapses that are not important. That's why next time this wrist movement is supposed to happen, the Purkinje cell firing was less, so because it was tuned down. So that is controlled by the climbing fiber activation, that big calcium spike. Okay. So they have a computational model. It's a very good example of how the computation and systems view helps to inform neuroscience. Okay. And actually, in my own work, I actually have some of that as well. Okay. Won't worry about this too much. This is basically just a big model of how the cerebellum could be working. The way people usually study cerebral function is with this thing called classical conditioning. Okay, classical conditioning is the following. So basically, you give a conditioned stimulus, right? In this case, it's a tone that does nothing. So you just do, do, do. And then that tone usually doesn't have any reflection on the human or the animal, right? But when you pair it with a unconditioned stimulus, so US, I'm just going to use these abbreviations. When you pair it with the US, which in this case is the air puff to the eye, so you puff of air, if you guys go to a eye doctor, you're going to notice when they do that, you go like this, right? You kind of, oh wait, shit, I got to blink, right? So now, what happens in this learning is that they give the tone and they give the air puff, right? So they got do-do-do, air puff, do-do-do, air puff. If you do that many, many times, it's kind of sad, right? But if you do that many, many times, do-do-do, shit, you're going to like, you're already ready to blink because you know that air puff is coming. Okay? So again, the air puff is the conditioned stimulus. I'll use it on the next lecture too, so pay attention. The unconditioned stimulus, US, is the air puff, right? It could be anything. It could be other things as well, but in this case, it's the air puff. And then the response, the conditioned response, is the blinking. The blinking is the conditioned response. So initially, the unconditioned stimulus, air puff, just elicits blinking on its own. So unconditioned response. But eventually, the tone can do it as well. Because the tone was paired with the air puff. So the tone, which is the CS, now evokes the CR, conditioned response. Okay? So basically you're learning, right? Because the tone initially didn't do anything. Like, before the experiment started, you go doon, 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 nothing, no response. After the experiment, without the air pump, you just go doon, 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 they go, right? They give you the conditioned response. So that's, if you get something from nothing, that's learning. You're learning something. Okay? So that's what people do, usually in like poor things like rabbits. This is one example where they study rabbits. Okay. So how do we know, for example, that Purkinje cells are important?
Okay.
So here's one study. So they have, in these animals, these are actually rats now. Yes, these are rats now, because they can do, rats or mice? I can't remember actually. Maybe it's mice. So in these mice, basically there's a type of mice where they are only devoid of Purkinje cells. So this is genetics. They go in there with a specific construct that kind of knocks out this. So this is a knockout mouse in the DNA sequence for Purkinje cell. Boom, gone. No Purkinje cell. Everything else is fine. No Purkinje cell. If you look at the wild type, which is they still have the Purkinje cell, you can see basically. So this is the response percentage. What that means is that over the course of this training, they learn to blink more and more to just the tone. Okay, this is why, as the number of days increases, you have an increase in the CR percentage. So that initially they're not really learning it, and then eventually, if you pair it many, many times, they learn that the tone is going to elicit. Okay, so this is why this is increasing over time. First, look at the wild type, which is on your circle. Okay, so you can see that they learn very quickly. Okay, in the Purkinje cell knockout, you can see that it's much reduced. Okay, what you should notice though is that even though it's reduced, they still do a little bit, right? You notice that this CR percentage, they don't learn as well as 80%, but they're going to go up to like a 40%. They're still going to learn something. And the reason for that actually is because the deep nuclei still has enough information there. So this is why I'll say later that the cortex, cerebral cortex, is not the only kind of movement center. It is a kind of modulation center. Okay? It turns out it's involved in the timing of it. So I'll tell you why in a second. So if you notice in this other animal in which the deep nucleus is lesion, which is these squares, right? They get no learning. So if you lesion the further downstream area from Purkinje cell, you really can get rid of this learning entirely. But in the knockout for Purkinje cell, you still get a little bit of something, but it's definitely reduced, showing that it's important for learning this eye blink reflex conditioning. Okay? Alright, so why is it that we say that the cerebellar cortex is important in this type of learning, right? So in what specific way? So here's one experiment that tries to figure out, well, look, you can still blink to even when there's no Purkinje cell. Why is that, right? So here's how it happens. So basically in this experiment, what they do is they give two different tones, right? So one tone that's like, the other tone that's like, dee, 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 okay? And both of those tones are going to predict the air puff, right? But one tone is longer and one tone is shorter, okay? So one tone is like, dee, 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 bo, right? The other tone is like, dee, 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 bo, okay? The air puff comes. Different timing. Okay. When you have a different timing, the animal can actually learn both of these cues. So the eye movement is up here on the upper part. You notice that this is a quick blink, right? So the one on the left, it's a blink. Because when the tone comes, beep, 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 it's gonna puff. So even with just the tone, it's gonna anticipate the puff. In the other tone, which is longer, it takes longer for them to make that eye blink. Because, hey, look, it learns that this takes that long for the blink to happen. Because the other tone is like, do, 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 or it's like, dee, 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 like earphones. So that's why the eye is kind of like, oh, I don't need to close it. Oh, close. Yeah. So this is the basics about how it happens, okay? So they have two different tones leading to both AirPods, and they can give you different responses of the eyes, right? All right. Now, what happens when you actually lesion the part of the cerebellar cortex that's specifically involved with this this kind of reflex, right? So, so when you do that, basically, what you can see on the B here, right? So it's pre-lesion versus post-lesion. I know it's hard to see here, but the pre-lesion are these big movements. So they're kind of these solid marks, right? And post-lesion are these kind of dotted signals, kind of lighter. I should have used different colors, but hopefully you guys can sort of see. But what you can see, just from one example, let's just concentrate on the upper one, right? What you can see is actually that after the lesion, they can actually move, they can still do a response, right? It's not timed properly, right? So for the CS1, actually, it's coming in before the CS, but it's still kind of relatively there. On the CS2, it also does this, but notice that it doesn't move with that eye movement. It never got delayed. So let's look at the second one now, here now. Here, when you do CS1, when you have a lesion, you get a smaller eye movement, but it's still there. So it's smaller here. Smaller deflection, but it's still there. When you lesion CS2, right, for the guys who got the CS2, you notice that that movement goes back to what the CS1 was like, right? Even though it learned to properly give the really long lesion earlier. So what does that mean? Is this confusing? Is it confusing? Because what that means is that after the lesion, the timing is disrupted. It's not that the fact that they're responding, they're still responding. They're both reduced, that's true. But the critical thing is that the timing information that was coming in from CS1, CS2, you no longer get that. You just get some response, right? So in this animal, you get response that's a little bit big, but very ill-timed at the very beginning. In the second animal, you get a timing that's a little bit better, but it's much reduced. But in both cases, the difference between CS1 and CS2, when you actually have that eye movement, that information is lost. So that's telling you that the cerebral lesion, in addition to what it's doing to the downstream motor signal, which is causing this reduction in the amplitude, whatever that does, regardless of that, it's also getting rid of the timing. You're no longer able to time properly your response. Because the critical study in the CS2, shows that it's just responding way early. It's barely responding, but it's just responding way early. Okay? So this experiment tells us that really is the timing. It is the timing aspect that's in addition to the kind of motor control aspect. So if you go back to our patient who's trying to say, you know, give me the duration between D and D, right? D, D, how many seconds or something like that? Well, they can't do this because they don't have the proper timing. Right? The world is not moving at the same pace for them. Okay. So I hope you guys can take away, if nothing else, from this lecture, is that the cerebellum, it influences how we think. It's not just, okay, well, you know, if you have damage up here, it changes your personality and things like that. It's not crazy like that, but it's crazy in another way, because when you damage it, you might not even have the proper sense of the world, like how fast things are. You might not even have the right timing for anything. Okay? It's like throwing a curveball on a fastball. Okay, so I spent a lot of time on this, so I'm going to skip some of this detail, but basically I already gave you the big story for that, because I want to talk just a little bit of about what I do in the remaining 20 minutes or so, because I also want to give you a little review quiz thing. I think summary is okay. I already kind of talked about it. Okay, so I want to tell you just briefly about some more advanced research about what we're doing, but then I'm going to give you the quiz. And then if we don't go beyond that, it's okay. But if there is, then I just give you some more information for fun. Okay, so going back to the first slides I show you about humans and cells, right? The question now is that can we link those two? Can we link that behavior to the actual circuit? Right. So that's going to be the theme both for this lecture and the next one. Okay. So this is what kind of research that I was involved in. Okay. So it turns out there's this neurotransmitter in the brain called GABA. Okay. So GABA usually is inhibitory. It usually inhibits. So when you release it, it inhibits the receptor for the next cell detects it, and then it gets inhibited. That cell gets inhibited because certain ions come in and inhibits the cell. Okay. In our research, what we found that this GABA action can actually be excitatory, paradoxically, in certain areas of the brain. And the area that we concentrated on are the molecular layer where the parallel fibers are. Okay. So this is just examples of how there could be excitatory action. So this is, again, evidence for excitatory action of GABA. I'm going to skip that for now. The way that I'm going to think about this is that, similar to what I showed before, is that we want to study many different levels. So first we have physiology, which is looking at using this technique called calcium imaging to figure out when the synapses are being activated. Okay, so that's on the left here. We also want to look at it in the sense of reading the, they're called fiber volleys, but basically they're just firing through the axon. So the firing, the reason it's called volley is because this signal just goes down the axon from one end to the other. That's why they're kind of volleys, right? They're kind of go straight down. But what they are is just a change in the membrane potential. So in other words, that compartment becomes more positive, and this positive kind of spreads down the axon. So basically, just when the cell fires, and this firing travels down the axon, which is the output part of the cell. Okay, and then we can also study this using the modeling idea that I talked to you about you know, the Mar Albus ETO, for example. Okay. So the first method, so first we put in this calcium indicator. So basically it's telling you how much calcium is in certain compartments. What you can do is that you can load that into the parallel fibers, and then you can stimulate a farther area away from where you're recording. And when you do that, that volley is going to come through the area that where you're recording. In this case, the recording is just imaging, actually, because it's reading out the calcium dye signal. And basically, you get an increase in the calcium signal, right? So they look like this. I know this is hard to read out. I'll tell you a little bit more about what's happening. But basically, this increase right here, that's the calcium signal, right? So when you stimulate, you get a calcium signal when you're imaging, right? And this is actually to time on this axis going into the page. Because what happens is that when you stimulate, you get a signal, and then you can stimulate again, and you can stimulate again, and then through time, you can do that many, many times, and you can get that curve many, many times. And what happens now is we're going to actually put in a drug called Mucimol, which is a GABA agonist. What that means is that it mimics GABA. It acts like GABA. It activates the same receptors as GABA. So ordinarily, it should be inhibited. So if you put Mucimol in some part of the brain, usually it inhibits activity. Like, for example, in the cortex, it usually can inhibit. It gets you sleepy, just like some of you are right now. The Mucimol goes in, you know, GABA thinks you're sleeping. Okay. In this case, though, what you can see is that the calcium signal actually increases when we put on Nusimol. Right? So that's an indication that somehow it's reverse of what it usually is. The GABA was inhibitory. In this case, it's actually exciting. Okay. This is what it means. So let's just look at the stuff on the right. Look at the control first, right? So the control, the blue curve is showing what happens when there's nothing happening. All you do is you stimulate. When you stimulate, you get a calcium signal indicating that there's an action potential going through the axon. So this is an increase, right? And then if you look at the green, that is after the Nusimol period. It goes back to where it was before. But when you notice that when you put on the Nusimol, you get an increase in that calcium signal, telling you that there's more activity, there's more fibers are activated, right, due to this Nusimol. It's exciting somehow. Okay, exciting. Gabazine is actually this blocker for Nusimol, for GABA. So gabazine is something that blocks the action of GABA. So when you put on gabazine, you still pump on Nusimol, but you put on gabazine. When you do that, when you now pump on the Nusimol, it doesn't do anything. So that's basically this lower graph, but also you can see right here. So this is, you put on gabazine and you still put on Nusimol, but the Nusimol now doesn't do anything because gabazine is blocking it. So it's exactly the same experiment as control, except you put on the GABA blocker. So the crucial thing with this is that it shows that it really is the GABA receptor that was being activated in the control case. Right? Okay. So recovery just means that after you wash out the Nusimol, you can actually basically try it again. Right, so you put on the Nusimol again. Oh, it works again, and then you can basically you keep doing it over and over. So each one of these dots on the summary graph on the left here is actually an individual increase calcium. So what that shows is that throughout time, in the control, when you put on the Nusimol, the calcium peak was bigger. Right, so the delta F over F is just the peak of the signal. When you put on gabazine, that no longer occurs. You no longer get the increase that you normally saw when you use it. Okay. So anyway, so the idea here is that really in the parallel fibers where I'm recording from, GABA is excitatory. And the question is, like, why is that and what's the consequence of that? Okay. So let me give you the questions. After the question, if we have time, I'll give you a little bit more about what I did, but basically, this is the big idea about what I did. So if you guys each have a piece of paper or something, I'm gonna give you like 10 minutes, but we're gonna grade them like pretty much right now. So all you need to is write it down on a piece of paper and then give it to a friend next door or something like that. Okay, so think about it. It's not, some of them is not super hard, some of them is a little bit more detailed, so see if you can figure out what it is. And this also serves as your like shuseki, like whether you're here or not. So if you don't do these, I actually don't know whether you're here or not. Okay. If you have any questions or you can't see the questions, then you should come up. I'll turn the light over this way.